Hare Krishna.
Spiritualizing our work. This is the topic we'll discuss today as a part of our Gita Leadership Series. So, suppose there are three teachers teaching in three adjacent classrooms. And some interviewer goes and asks each of these teachers, "What are you doing?" The first teacher just snaps sullenly, "Can't you see? I am trying to teach these lazy kids." The interviewer goes to the second teacher and asks, "What are you doing?" He says, "I am earning my living." Goes to the third teacher and asks, third teacher says, "I am helping shape the world's future." Now, the activity is the same, but the vision is different. And our vision determines our inspiration. To do anything worthwhile in life, we need commitment. And how much we can commit ourselves to any particular activity depends largely on how much of an inspiring vision we have about that activity. How we see that activity determines how much we will want to do it when there are difficulties which will dishearten us, which will make us feel maybe I should just give it up. And such a inspiring vision is vital for leaders, because leading a team through all the inevitable crises that come in any project and then taking the team ultimately to success is no easy task. It requires enormous commitment. And for that commitment to be there, the leaders need to have an inspiring vision of their work. And their principles, their priorities, their practices, which all will flow out of their vision, are going to percolate down the whole organization. And they will affect the organization at large. They're shaping the work ethos in that organization. So, now, how can we have develop an inspiring vision for our work? The Bhagavad Gita offers us such a vision, such a redefinition of our work, so that it is not just something we do to earn a living or to gain fame, but it is something we do for our and others' ultimate well-being. It becomes an offering of loving service to the divine and to everyone in relationship with the divine. Such is the vision that the Gita offers us of work. Now, to understand this vision, we'll need to look at first the concept of yoga in the Gita. Now, the Bhagavad Gita is quintessentially a yoga text. Every one of its chapters is called a yoga chapter. Karma Yoga is the name, for example, of the third chapter. 12th chapter is Bhakti Yoga. So, like that, each chapter is called yoga. And similarly, we see that the word yoga itself comes 75 times in the Bhagavad Gita. And if we take the variants of the word, the other forms of the word like yogi or yukta, then we have almost 158 times the word coming. And so actually nearly 20% of the Gita's 700 verses feature yoga or its variants. So that means yoga is a central point of the message of the Gita. Now, what does the word yoga mean? Normally, most people think this is a dark question. It's obvious. Yoga means sitting in a particular posture, pedestal positions for improving one's health or improving one's figure. However, that can be called yoga, but that is only one type, one level in one type of yoga. To understand the meaning of the word yoga, we can look back at its semantic roots. The word yoga comes from the word yuju, and it is cognate to the English yoke. Now, and this linguistic cousin of yoga can help us visually understand the import of yoga. So, yoke is a device used to connect two things, say a cow and a plow. So similarly, yoga is a activity, is a system meant to connect two things. What are those two things? There's a human consciousness and there's a divine consciousness to connect us with life's deepest reality. So the Bhagavad Gita explains that the locus of our consciousness is the soul. And the divine consciousness manifests most completely as God, as Krishna. So in the most evolved sense of the word, yoga means to connect the soul with Krishna. Now, for bringing about this connection, there are various kinds of yoga. The Bhagavad Gita primarily talks about four different yogas. There is Karma Yoga, which is the yoga of action. And there is Jnana Yoga, which is the yoga of contemplation, yoga of knowledge. Then there is Dhyana Yoga, which is the yoga of meditation. And then there is Bhakti Yoga, that is the yoga of devotion, yoga of love. So, now all these yogas help one to move forwards towards fulfilling the purpose of yoga, that is establishing a connection with our indwelling reality. So, now the Bhagavad Gita itself describes these various yogas. And now we'll go into these four yogas a little later, but let's return back to the normal conception of yoga and see how it relates with this more evolved understanding of yoga. The normal conception of yoga is as particular bodily postures. Now actually these postures are also mentioned about in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna talks about this in 6.11, 12, 13. So 6.12 and 11 he says, Shucha Udeshe Patishthapya Sthiramasanam Atmana Natyuchritam Natinicham Chailajinakushottaram. So he says, sit in a secluded place, sacred place, on asana, don't let it be too high or too low. He gives various practical guidelines for what should be done. Chailajina kushottaram and kushottaram. Use a kusha grass pointed in the uttara direction. And like that he gives descriptions. And then further he says, Tatraikagram manakritva yatachitendriya kriya upavishyasane yunjad yogamatma vishuddhaye ekagram manakritva. Calm the mind down. Upavishyasane yunjad yatachitendriya kriya and silence, regulate, control the activities of senses and of consciousness. And then sit down, upavishyasane yunjat, to engage in meditation, yogam atma vishuddhaye, for purifying the soul. And then further it describes the asana, samam kaya shiro grivam dharayana chalam sthiraha samprekshanasika gramswam dishaschanavalokayan. So samam kaya shiro grivam, so kaya is head, shira is Kaya is body, Shira is head, and Griva is the neck. So put the neck, the back, and the head, the torso in one line. Dharayan achalam sthiraha, be unmoving, be not restless, give up restlessness. Samprekshanastika gramswam, and fix the eyes on the tip of the nose. Why the tip of the nose? It's just some external point of concentration to bring about the focus. Dishascha navalokayan and na avalokayan. Avalok means to look. Don't look in various directions. Just focus on the tip of the nose. So now this is a description of the asanas. And this process of yoga is further described in the classic Patanjali Yoga Sutras, which are considered the classic book on yoga. Now in these Yoga Sutras, what happens? Krishna describes Patanjali describes yoga is having 8 stages. There is yama, is prohibition, things which one should not do. Niyama, things which one should do, the observances or prescriptions. Then asana is the postures. So this is the third stage, yoga asanas as they are called. Pranayama is the breathing exercises. And then after that, pratyahar, it is shutting off the senses, rejecting external inputs, turning inwards by that. Then there is dharana, and there is concentration, that is dhyana, is meditation, and ultimately samadhi is absorption in the absolute truth. So now, in these stages, if we see, asana is a third stage, and actually the asana is meant to be a takeoff point for the consciousness to go inwards. Once you settle the body in a particular posture, then by that the mind becomes calm and then it can turn inwards. So the asanas have a transitional instrumental nature. The asana is not the goal, it's an instrument for the inner quest. Now the process of Dhyana Yoga also requires that one renounce the world, go to the forest, as we discussed, Ucha Udeshe Pratishthapya. So go to the forest, and that is required by the Pratyahara stage, generally, so that the person can shut out the world and focus on the Supreme. So now, without renouncing the world, yogic path does not lead to spiritual perfection. And renouncing the world is required also in Jnana Yoga. And these yogas, of course, they can lead to some benefits without renouncing, but then for the ultimate benefit, renunciation of the world is required. And since leaders are to act in this world, their primary aspirations, contributions, actions are going to be in this world, so these world-rejecting forms of yoga are not very relevant for leaders. Of course, leaders may do some asanas for maintaining or enhancing their health, but that is just an appropriation of one limb of one type of yoga. And to mistake that to be the full practice of yoga, that just because I am doing asanas, I am a yogi, to think like that is to deprive oneself of the huge empowerment that one can get through yoga. So now, if the yoga asanas are a part of Dhyan Yoga, which is impractical because it requires world renunciation, then what are the more practical forms of yoga? Which yogas allow one to engage in the world also? Yes, there are primarily two. There is Karma Yoga and Bhakti Yoga. Now, in many ways, these two are similar because their focus is, their commonality is that one engages in the world, but for a higher spiritual purpose. In Karma Yoga, it is for the purpose of developing detachment and knowledge. And in Bhakti Yoga, it is for developing devotion. The primary difference is thus in one's focus. In Karma Yoga, the focus is still on the karma. Okay, I'm going to do this activity, but I'll do it with detachment. In Bhakti Yoga, the focus is more on the object of yoga. That is God. One does the work in a mood of devotion. So, actually Karma Yoga and sometimes these yogas are thought to be as independent paths, all leading to the same spiritual perfection. All these paths are progressive in that they take us towards perfection, but they are not independent. The Karma Yoga actually leads to Bhakti Yoga. That's what Krishna tells twice in the Bhagavad Gita in 3.9 and 3.30. He says, Yajnathat karmano anyatra lokoyam karma vandana. One should work for the purpose of satisfaction of Yajna. Yajna is just another name for Vishnu or Krishna. And then Maya Sarvani Karmani Sanyasyadhyatma Chetasa Nirashir Nirmama Bhutva Yudhyasvigatajvara. Offer all the fruits of your work to me and be detached, and this way you will stay in spiritual consciousness and you will attain eventually perfection in life. This is 3.30. So the point is that the various yogas, as far as the Bhagavad Gita is concerned, they culminate in bhakti. So now if somebody comes to know about the object of devotion, then one can skip the Karma Yoga process and go directly to Bhakti Yoga. That means, from Karma Yoga, one will graduate to Bhakti. But the difference between Karma Yoga and Bhakti Yoga is that, in Karma Yoga, one doesn't know who is the object of yoga. But if one understands that the object of yoga is God, then one can devote oneself to God right from the beginning itself. So one can practice Bhakti Yoga right from the beginning. And this is talked about in 18.56 towards the end of the Gita, Sarva Karmani Pisada Purvano Madhvipashraya. Krishna says that Sarva Karmani Pisada, whatever work one may be doing, one can do that, but still one can take shelter of me. And Mat Prasada Davapnoti, by my prasad, you'll attain Shashvatam Padamome. One will attain the eternal destination. So now, so that means, Bhakti Yoga is a ladder which extends down, down, down to the lowest level from which it can lift people up. In fact, in 9.32, it is said in the Bhagavad Gita that actually one can elevate oneself, that Bhakti Yoga can elevate a person irrespective of any past mental condition, irrespective of any discriminations of caste or race or gender. Everybody can be elevated by Bhakti Yoga. Mam hi partha vyapakshitya yepi syu papa yo naya striyo vaishyasta shudras tepi yanti paramgatim. Everyone can attain the supreme destination. So in that sense, Bhagavad Gita universalizes the path, Bhakti Yoga universalizes the path of yoga, making it accessible to everyone. The reach of Bhakti doesn't just extend downwards to the lowest level. Sometimes people think that Bhakti is for sentimental people and other paths are for other people who are intellectual or austere. No, Bhakti's scope extends not just downward to the lowest people, but also extend upwards to the zenith, the highest summits of spiritual perfection. In fact, the Bhagavad Gita describes that whatever summit one might attain by other paths, that if a jnani attains perfection by the jnana path, then after that, the jnani has to move forward and attain bhakti. So this is Krishna talks about 18.54. It says, Brahma bhuta prasannatma na shochati na kaangshati samah sarveshu bhuteshu mad bhaktim labhate param. So after one has attained the Brahman level, that is the perfection of the jnana path, then what happens? Then one attains bhakti. So that is 18.51. Similarly, in 6.47, Krishna says that the perfection of the path of Dhyana Yoga is also to fix the mind on Him. Yoginam api sarvesham madgatena antaratmana shraddhavan bhajate yoma same yukta tamo mataha. So of course, all this may seem very technical. The essential point in all this analysis is that the Bhagavad Gita is very clear that Bhakti Yoga is the best, the most recommended path for everyone to practice. And Bhakti Yoga is especially relevant for us as leaders, for those who are interested in leadership insights in the Bhagavad Gita. Why? Because Bhakti Yoga offers the most evolved motivation for work, even in this world. Now, when we do any work, when leaders do their work, their motivation can be various things. But normally, the motivations will fall broadly in one of these four categories. It's fear, desire, duty, and love. So fear means that one is working as a leader, but one is fearful. Oh, if I don't do my job well, then I may get fired. My company may become bankrupt. And what will happen to me then? So this is actually a stress-driven, worry-centered, quite a negative focus for working. And of course, such a focus may come up because of the high pressure in today's competitive world. But still, it's a negative focus. And it often drains one's energy. And often one's approach becomes reactionary, just trying to avert danger and solve problems. A reactionary approach is not visionary. And such an approach cannot lead one to any tangible achievement or any worthwhile contribution. A higher level than fear is desire, where one is motivated by more. Yes, I want more pay. I want more perks. I want a higher position. And I want fame. I want acclaim. I want rewards. So for this one works. Now in this sense here, the energy is positively channeled, not negatively pushed or something like that. But so in that sense it's higher, but this actually can become a source of collateral damage. Collateral damage is a word used in the military. It's a euphemism for unintended harmful consequences. So when leaders are fueled too much by their desire, unregulated desire, then they may trample on whatever comes in the way of achieving their goals. So their relationships get neglected, then people get overworked, resources get unduly exploited, and often at the end of it, one stands at the top, but one is lonely at the top, totally lonely. In fact, this can have not just work done with an unregulated desire motive, can harm not just oneself, and not just one's organization, but even the world at large. For example, if we see the leaders of industry over the last few centuries have focused excessively on indiscriminate industrialization. And for that, there has been deforestation, there has been exploitation of natural resources, and we have severely disrupted the ecological balances, the delicate ecological balances that sustain our fragile biosphere. And there are, therefore, one of the many dangers of that is we are facing the specter of climate change. So, desire may be productive in the short run, but it will be destructive in the long run. It definitely is not a sustainable motive. And another motive could be duty. Like, I have got this position and I have my responsibility to my organization, I have responsibility to my employees, and then of course I have a family to maintain, so I have responsibility to my family, so therefore I'll do my job. Now in one sense this is going to be steadier and healthier, because the uncertainty of desire, because when one is motivated by desire, then one is never sure one's desire will be fulfilled or not, and therefore one often may go, one's mood will go in sine waves. In desire and duty, one remains steadier. In that sense, it's better. But still, duty can over time become burdensome. Oh, I have to keep doing this work all the time, all the time, all the time. And we need, for sustenance, more positive infusion of some more positive vision into our relationship with our work. And that brings us to the level of love. Now, how can leaders approach their work with love? Now, love for work can be at two levels. It can be at the level of our psychophysical nature, and it can be at the level of our spiritual identity. So, the Bhagavad Gita actually recommends both. So, at one level, it can mean, say, if a scientist loves the field when he's working, or he or she is working on, and it's absorbed in the research, or an artist or a musician loves to live in the world of music, a teacher feels in full flow when one is when standing in front of the classroom. These are all examples of people who love their work, and the Bhagavad Gita actually encourages and facilitates such love for one's work by its injunction of acting according to one's nature. So, Swabhava Niyatam Karma, the Bhagavad Gita says, work according to one's Swabhava, one's nature. So, essentially it refers to what? It refers to working according to one's talents. So, in fact, the culture which is built around the Bhagavad Gita had an intricate and elaborate system called Varanashrama that enabled people to be engaged according to their talents, according to their inclinations, according to their abilities. And though, of course, sadly, regrettably, this system later degenerated to the discriminatory birth-based caste system. But the original system was meant to be according to propensities and proficiencies, guna and karma. What are one's qualities and what are one's competencies, abilities. So that basically it was meant to enable people to work according to their specific talents. Now key leaders know how important it is for a team to have members being given the right roles. The team's efficiency can shoot up when right people are placed in the right roles. We can just imagine how phenomenal would be the productivity if a society could arrange for all its members to be placed in the right roles according to their nature. So significantly, the Bhagavad Gita's vision of love doesn't stop over here. It goes deeper to our spiritual essence. It understands that we are not just material creatures, and we are not just meant to be performers of work. And our perfection is not to do with a robotic repetitive efficiency the same routine again and again and again. That's not exactly what we long to do. Now, we are conscious beings and we long to love and to be loved. And Bhagavad Gita explains that actually our longing to love comes from our deepest core. As souls, we are parts of God and we are meant to love and live eternally with Him. So many times people have a stereotype of spirituality that spirituality requires one to reject all emotions as illusory. But the Bhagavad Gita doesn't ask us to reject our emotions. It asks us to redirect our emotions. So, redirect means what? It explains that because we are parts of God, so to, the desire to love is natural and we need to love the whole. And in loving the whole, we find lasting satisfaction. Just as when the hand satisfies the stomach, the hand gets satisfaction. So, similarly, we are meant to serve and contribute to the whole. Now, how do we contribute to the whole? And who is the whole? How we contribute is through yoga. And this brings us to the level 4, the level of love. And who is the whole to whom we contribute? This brings us to one of the most important revelations in the Bhagavad Gita. That is, its vision of the absolute truth. Many times people think of the spiritual perfection as an infinity of effulgent light. Bhagavad Gita acknowledges this dimension of the absolute truth, but then it describes that there is a higher dimension, and that is infinity of love manifested as an omnipotent, all-attractive person. That person is known by different names in different traditions, and he is known in the Bhagavad Gita by the name Krishna. So now, the Bhagavad Gita is clear that there is no conception of absolute truth higher than this. 7.7 in the Gita states, Mattah Parataram Nanyad Kinchidasti Dhananjaya. There is no truth beyond me. And whatever else exists, the Bhagavad Gita states that it all comes from Krishna. 10.8 in the Gita states, Aham Sarvasya Prabhavo Mattah Sarvam Pravartate. Everything emanates from me. All things are sustained by me. And then further, to make things more explicit and specific, in 14.26 Krishna says that Brahmano hi pratishtaham. And even the infinity of light that is often thought of as the absolute truth among those who have a preliminary knowledge of the Gita. So even that infinity of light is actually resting in Krishna. It's coming from Krishna. So Krishna is the ultimate, highest manifestation of the absolute truth. And he is a living, loving person. And the purpose and perfection of life is to reciprocate love with him eternally. And our longing for love is perfectly and completely and eternally fulfilled when we direct our loving propensity towards Krishna. So now, what does this imply for us as when we are talking about leadership over here? So actually, the Bhagavad Gita describes the highest perfection as not just a merging of beings, but as a joining of hearts in love. Not an eternity of impersonal silence, but an eternity of loving reciprocation. And that re-envisioning of life as a reciprocation of love is not restricted in the Gita to just some other world beyond this. That is accessible even in this world. And in this world actually becomes redefined as an arena for love. And leaders can see their projects, their work as a part of an offering of love that they are doing for God and all His children. So, when we understand that God is the ultimate object of love, that doesn't mean that we don't care for anyone else. We understand that God is connected with everyone. So, we have a vertical relationship with God and we have a horizontal relationship with other people in the world. And we see them all as members of one family. We are all members of the same family of God. And in this way, now we get a deeper vision of how we can serve God and express our love for Him even in this world. How do we do that? There can be broadly three ways of looking at the world. One is, it is an object for recreation. Second is, it's an object for rejection. And third is, it's an object for reciprocation. So, object for recreation means these people think, oh, this world is a very good place and we can enjoy. All that we need to do is just get more and more resources, get more and more things, and then we will enjoy this world. And it's that people even accept the existence of God their conception of God is that he is simply meant to act as a protector and provider of the enjoyments of this world. This is actually, in the Vedic parlance, called as the path of karma. There are three marga: karma marga, jnana marga, and bhakti marga. So the karma marga thinks of this world as a place of enjoyment. Then there is the vision of this world as an object for rejection. That is the vision of the jnana marga. So the idea is that, oh, this world is an evil place. It is filled with temptations that will entice and entrap and entangle. So that there seem to be pleasures in this world, but those pleasures are followed by great miseries, and therefore we must turn away from this world. And those jnanis who are on this path, they focus more on turning away from the world than turning towards God. The bhakti marga sees the world as an object for reciprocation. Reciprocation means we see that this world is created by God. The resources that are there in the world belong to God. The gifts that we have, the talents and abilities that we have, they are also gifts from God. So what we are meant to do is use the world's external resources and use our inner resources all as an expression of love for God and as an expression of service for our fellow human beings, fellow living beings in God's family. So the Bhagavad Gita describes in 5.39 that Sarva Loka Maheshwaram, that God is the proprietor of everything, including everything in this world and the world itself, and all the worlds in fact. So therefore, it is he who should be served by the object, by our activities in this world. And when we re-envision this world as an object of service, then we become more responsible, more competent, because we understand that this is how we will express our love to God. No. Love can be the greatest motivator. Where do we see such an example of selfless hard work as in a mother with a newborn baby? The mother often works on all-night shifts without pay just to care for her precious infant. The baby may just wake up at any time at night, and the mother immediately wakes and comforts the baby when the baby starts crying or has some need. So, actually, love can be the highest motivator. And this love can motivate not just our activities of devotion to God in terms of directly devotional activities like praying, meditating, worshipping, but that mood can be infused in all our activities. And in that way, love can become the motivator for all activities. And that brings us to another important teaching of work as worship. So now there is this catchphrase, work is worship. So now as a moral lesson, it is fine. Now, that just as we do worship reverentially, we should also do work reverentially. And also that we should not consider any work a low level. You want the concept of dignity of labor. Yes, imparting those moral lessons, work is worship is a fine enough slogan. But often work is worship is elevated to a philosophical principle. And that elevation is problematic. And often this equalization of work as worship, work is worship, is ascribed to the Bhagavad Gita. Now first let's look at the logical and then let's look at the scriptural problems with this. Now logically, if work is worship, then a donkey is in folklore considered to be the most hard worker. So is the donkey the greatest worshipper? Or I say if a robber is going out to rob and the robber says, it's my job, it's my work. So if a robber going to rob, is that also worship? So now of course, these objections are in a lighter vein, but the point is that actually work is worship is a very simplistic catchphrase, but the catchphrase is a catch. It doesn't stand serious logical scrutiny. That doesn't mean it's wrong, it just has to be qualified properly. It has to be contextualized and understood properly. In what context it can be, it becomes true, and what context it doesn't remain true. So now, let's now move forward to the Bhagavad Gita. Now, although this work is worship is ascribed to the Bhagavad Gita, there is no verse in the Bhagavad Gita itself which talks about this directly there is no verse in the Bhagavad Gita. Now the only verse that can be related with it, where worship and work are brought together in the Bhagavad Gita, is 18.46, which says, Svakarmana tam abhyarcha siddhim vindati manava yata pravrittir bhutanam yena sarvam idam tatam. Svakarmana tam abhyarcha siddhim vindati manava. So, yata pravrittir bhutanam, that Lord who is the source of everyone, yena sarvam idam tatam, by whom all this world is pervaded, svakarmana tam abhyarcha, by your work, worship him. And siddhim vindati manava, you will attain perfection by this. So there is a very significant phrasing of it. Swakarmana tam abhyarcha. Swakarmana is by your work. Abhyarcha is worship. Tam is that Lord. By your work, worship him. That means it's not that work is worship. Work can be a means to worship the Lord. So work as a worship. It's not that work automatically, intrinsically is worship. But work can be made into a worship. How? By a devotional service disposition. And cultivating the disposition is important. Otherwise, work itself does not become worship. And how it cannot and can become worship. To understand this, let's first look at the differences in work and worship. Now, work normally deals with this world. Now, we all want to do something tangible in this world, make some meaningful contribution. That is one of the nobler motives that people have for work. Whereas worship normally refers to things beyond this world. It ultimately refers to the Lord who is the highest reality beyond this world. So then how can these two, work with, which relates to this world and worship which relates to the next world, how can these two be linked? Actually, they can be linked in the human heart. Because it is the human heart that wants to make tangible contributions here, and it is also the human heart that wants to adore some otherworldly object beyond this world. So how can the two be brought together? In the human heart. When the human heart has the right consciousness, one understands that Lord whom I want to worship, he is beyond this world, but even this world belongs to him. The abilities with which I am going to do work in this world also belongs to him. And the resources with which I am going to work also belong to him. So, by using these resources, abilities and resources in a service mood, in a devotional mood, I can actually worship that Lord. So with this mood, when one cultivates, this mood has to be cultivated not just as a sentiment, but as a systematic contemplation and internalization. So when that happens, then one can actually make one's work into worship. And leaders who work in this worship mode, they can be top performers, not just in terms of getting top results, but in terms of making top contributions, because they see the complete picture and they will not sacrifice a long term for short term. They will attain a balance between the things. They will attain sustainable success and they will make sustainable contributions to society, because their definition of success is broader. It is not just meeting particular targets. Yes, they will meet the targets because they will offer in their mood of loving devotion, they'll offer the best that they can because it's a service to God. And they will offer their best, but along with that, they will also think of the long-term good, long-term best also. So their goal is not just to achieve targets, their goal is to please God. And God is pleased not just by short-term results, but also by the long-term results. Is pleased ultimately by our intention to please him. So, now this brings us to the concept of servant leadership. You know, it's a popular saying now that we are not leaders, we are servant leaders. So, servant leadership is a important concept, and the Bhagavad Gita gives a philosophical foundation and a spiritual orientation for it. Philosophically, when you understand that it's not just an external designation that we accept, okay, I'm a servant leader. We are actually servants at our very core. We are servants of God, and by His arrangement, we may be put in the leadership position. So we are, in that sense, servant leaders. And then spiritual orientation means we understand that other living beings are also parts of God, and by serving them also we serve God. So in that way, when we see all of them as members of one family, then there is no destructive competitive mood, because other success, the success of someone else in our family, is also our success, because we are one unit. So like that, the team develops a high level of synergy because people see each other as a family and therefore they can move forward in a cooperative, synergistic way. And such synergistic teams can achieve far, far more than what can be achieved by teams that are ruptured by separatist agendas and self-centered motives, as happens with most teams. And actually, leaders who infuse this vision of devotion in their work, they can, and today's competitive world is emotionally sapping. It's like a desert. But leaders who can imbibe this mood of devotion, they can, by their examples and through the example of their teams, create oases where emotionally rich performances and performers can flourish and set examples for replication in the society and the world at large. And in this way, work as done as a worship can actually benefit the individual, benefit the team, benefit the organization, and benefit the world. And not just in terms of this worldly benefit, but this worldly and other worldly benefits. All round welfare can be done when we infuse our work with a devotional motivation and do it diligently as a form of worship. Thank you. Hare Krishna.